the Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023, Millennial 9. I think this is the 15th, yes, this is the 15th night, and this is also the final night of the main schedule. After this, it will be one-off streams. So later on, it will be, hold on a second, Frode Midjord and then Pox Populi and then the Christmas card stream. But first of all, it's David Scott. David Scott has appeared on Millennial before as part of UK Column. He's now going solo. So, David, welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you very much, Colin. It's lovely to be with you again. And right. it's lovely to have... I've just finished the set you see behind me today. So this is the first time it's ever been seen. So that's grand as well.
Yes, and we were talking before we went on air about the neon sign and how lovely it is. It's something that I've always had great fondness for. I should say sorry about the late start. There were technical issues on my end, that things that I had to get done for later on. So it's not David's fault, and I do apologise. Okay, so David, this year has been an unravelling in many ways, I think, of different power structures. The Ukraine conflict has failed, well, at least from the Western point of view. And of course, Queen Elizabeth II died. And Charles III was coronated, and then other things, obviously the Gaza conflict. You want to talk specifically about the Queen Elizabeth II, and I think this is a good topic because it hasn't come up before on Millennial, apart from here and there, just briefly. So I think, well, and Apostolic Majesty, of course, the second stream, we talked about it there. What is your perspective of the royal family in Britain as an institution, the monarchy, and then the Windsors, and then Queen Elizabeth herself? Let's start with the monarchy as an institution. What would you have to say about that in the British context? Because it is quite unique in Britain. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that my personal view is this is extremely important. This goes back... not just hundreds of years, thousands of years. If you look at the Declaration of Arbroath, it talks about the kingly line going back before the Scots were even in Scotland. You know, when they were in Ireland, when they were in Spain, when they were travelling along the length of the Mediterranean from where they started. This is a very ancient institution. And, of course, like all ancient institutions, modernity and the left and the postmodernists want to destroy it. They want to destroy everything. And I very much want to see it preserved. And I think it will be preserved, but for reasons that are beyond politics. So it means a lot to me, but the application of it in the current political environment is something else entirely. And I know you've read an article I did for the UK Column when the Queen died, and this was partly in response to really a very hostile, almost bitter in places, response to this from many aspects of what you might term the alternative media. And that's not how I felt, and I tried to express how I felt in the article. But of course, it's complex because it's not jingoistic, and it was a mixture of affection. There was definitely a lot of affection and some sympathy for her and for what she was trying to do, and the realization that she was in a position where she found herself as the nominal head of a country that was going seriously awry, that had forgotten who we'd forgotten who we were. We had lost our way as a nation. And one person was never going to turn that round. So there was a lot of sympathy for that. But also there was this regret that more hadn't been done. There had been this sorry compromise with the decline of Britain. And there hadn't been, she'd never been a rallying point for people with views that suggest that slow decline and amalgamation into the European superstate wasn't actually the way our nation should be going. So there was also a feeling of maybe a little bit of betrayal. So it was very much mixed feelings, very difficult passing, a very difficult thing to respond to, I found. But yeah, overall, affection, sadness, and regret.
But obviously we can talk more about that, but I want to get your understanding of the British monarchy, what a British monarch should be, in obviously historically, but also now and in the 20th century. What, you know, I want to get that before we zoom in on Elizabeth II.
Yeah, that's a tricky one because it's an anachronism in the 21st century. It's something that dates from thousands of years ago, and it's remaining. And actually, I think it's Elizabeth II quote. She's her role is to be, not to reign. It seems to be a case of trying to keep the institution in being, whatever the compromises that are necessary, and just to keep it there, just to get it to the next generation and the next generation, without it trying to steer anything or without it actually leading, which was my biggest criticism of Elizabeth II, there wasn't enough leadership. What is it? It's very difficult to know because it's changed again. And each generation has had less influence, has had less power, has had less direction over the nation. And I think in this particular age, if that was to turn around, it would require ideas. We are in an age of direct communication. We are in an age where the people can, if the monarch chose to speak to us, could tune in any time they liked. But obviously, that's not happening. And the ideas that are being pushed by Charles are very much the ideas of internationalism, the ideas of the World Economic Forum, the ideas of global warming, the ideas of surrender your liberty in order to protect you from climate catastrophe, and all of this nonsense. So here we have this ancient institution with the potential to be a rallying point, with the potential to be the point of leadership, with the potential to have a direct communication and relationship with the people in a way that the politicians never do, because the politicians are here today, gone tomorrow to a very large extent. You know, the joke about they're like nappies, diapers. They should be changed frequently and for the same reason. There's an insubstantial issue about politicians, and it's not quite as personal, because with a monarch, it is personal. It's that human being, and there's a relationship between every member of the country and that human being. This has got a lot of potential, but it's not at the moment being realised, because the ideas that are ruling there are ones of error.
Yeah, I also think the very concept that people would, that the public would put their faith in an individual is kind of old-fashioned, because we're supposed to put our faith in values and principles, not even, and less so in the nation state itself, less so in the nation itself. So then to make it even more sharply focused and place your faith in the monarch seems very anachronistic.
Well, it was, but of course it was never, It was never really that, because the monarch was always ruling, at least in theory, in a manner directed by God. There was a hierarchy, and God was at the top of it, and the monarch wasn't. And therefore, it was about values, it was about principles, and it wasn't about the individual. It certainly wasn't a cult of personality, or shouldn't have been, whatever tended to transpire in the historical record as something else. But it should and could, and still might be, that principled stand on ideas. Which I think was a big part of it, if you go back several hundred years. The idea of the monarch and the idea of Britain and the idea of the principles on which the nation was built were all mixed in there together. And the monarch was maybe a shorthand notation for it, but it meant much more than the individual.
Oh, of course. I acknowledge that. I guess my point is that now we're not supposed to see these things as encoded in a nation at all, but sort of universal principles, universal values. So, and indeed, even to disparage our own nation, that this is a big part of the decline throughout the 20th century of British people losing faith in Britain as a thing, as an entity. And I think that is the fashionable view. And when you get to someone, well, let's talk about Elizabeth II herself then, because I think your essay, and I've linked it in the comments, it does talk about time and time again when she could have done something or said something, but just didn't. So it's a litany of failures to engage with the issues, the mechanisms of her time. She would still shake hands with ordinary people. She would engage in that way. But meantime, the world was being transformed around her. And I think one thing that's worth saying here is that there is no dress rehearsal for being a monarch. Or indeed, obviously this goes for other jobs as well, other positions. But it's not like there was somebody there to tell her, here's how I dealt with the world in the 19th century. Here's how you can deal with it in the 20th century. Because that advice would be meaningless. It's a completely different world, certainly from 1950 onwards. So I don't see how she... This is, the point I'm making is I don't know how prepared she could possibly have been for the challenge. I don't know how aware she could even be of the challenge, because how much would have been obvious, and how much could a young woman be prepared for these things?
That's a very fair point. I mean, she was very young. When her father died, it was a shock to her, to everyone else. We were back in the 50s. We were back where the empire was still quite a major issue, quite a major thing, where the Royal Navy was a very major institution, for example. We were in an age where it wasn't clear, the direction of travel may have been clear, but it wasn't clear how things would actually work out. The decline in the confidence in Britain in itself was a strange thing. And this has gathered pace, obviously, in recent years, because you had this strange period after the Second World War where part of how we defined ourselves was our role in the Second World War. We watched war films, we took in the history of real and mythical about the standard nation made then, and that gave us an understanding of ourselves. And that seemed to last a while, and round about, I think, the mid-60s, things started to change very substantially. The principles in terms of beliefs, in terms of morals that the country had been comfortable with and built itself on, they started to be challenged, they started to be eroded. And when that hit, I think things galloped away in a way that few people had seen. Now, what would have been the points where she might have stood up and had said, no, let's have a constitutional crisis over this one, because this matters that much. Right? And the two that stand out, I think, are joining the European Union and the surrender of sovereignty that goes with it. And the other one was the attack on marriage and the family, and which was the glue that held the country together. And was, I think she should have been aware of this, was part of the Marxist left approach to how to destroy the West, how to destroy nations like Britain. Right? They were going to go after certain things. We're going to go after the idea of the country, the nation. They were going to go after the church and faith, and they were going to go after the family. And by here they did. And unfortunately, our monarch didn't stand up and speak out in the way that I would have wanted her to, and many others would too.
Wouldn't you say a third time when she could have intervened, or you know, ideally would have intervened, would be the effective abolition of the House of Lords by Tony Blair?
Yeah, I mean, we're still dealing with the shambles that he made of our constitution, and the effect of the Blair government, and effect of the Blair government's decisions and actions in the first year or two of taking office were so profound, and in many ways so damaging. We're still trying to work out what to do with it, because the House of Lords was destroyed as a workable, viable, practical institution. And what do we get in place? We got some sort of cronyism and popularity contest to put people in there to do not very much.
Well, it's a top shop for acolytes of Tony Blair and the Prime Minister of the time.
Yeah.
The reason I say it's an abolition is that it's obviously no longer about hereditary power. It's no longer about the aristocracy. So in that sense, I mean, I guess you can call them lords, but they're not lords in any meaningful way.
And when it was a power base for the landed interest against the commons, which is a power base for the town and the industrial interests, there was a certain logic to that. And there was also a certain, purpose and practical. You had people who had a very long-term view in a checking and revising role against the commons, which, like all democracies, has a view that only goes as far as the next election, if that far. So short-termism was somewhat corrected by people who were thinking in terms of centuries, who were thinking in terms of their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And that's obviously gone. And there's now various talks about what we're going to get to replace the obviously inappropriate system that we've now got in the House of Lords. Some form of federal state seems to be the favourite. And Gordon Brown, bless his heart, is going to be probably the man generating the ideas. This is not good news. Any ideas that come from Gordon Brown are always bad ideas. But if the Labour Party get in, as seems likely, at the next general election, we're going to have Gordon Brown, who is obviously Tony's sidekick, coming back, I think, to finish the job on the second chamber.
Yeah, well, Gordon Brown, it's funny you say that, because I've actually been doing research recently, and he has been generating ideas for the direction of the left since the 80s. He came up with something that is now, I think, completely forgotten, which was the University for Industry in the 90s. Completely forgotten now. And it was actually a big thing throughout that whole decade in the run-up to New Labour taking power. That was one of their big projects, along with the Millennium Dome. It was one of their big projects in that first term. I'm interested in what you would say about, because you did mention this things that they did in their first year or two in power. This is 1997 to 98, that rewrote the constitution or disrupted the constitution of the country. Which things would you include in that list?
Well, the first thing that they did when they came in was, quote, independence for the Bank of England. Right, a strange concept, given the fact that the Bank of England is partly owned by the Treasury and ultimately is underwritten by the Treasury. So how it could ever be independent is unclear to me. But nominally, independence of the Bank of England. Now, what this did was, it was a short-term political fix, right? Because what traditionally happens with Labour governments is they come in, they tax and spend, there's a run in the pound, there's a balance of payments crisis, there is a sterling crisis, and as a result, all of the policies have to be put into reverse. Traditionally, that's what Labour governments have been. So this was heading that off at the pass, because he did two things. Gordon Brown, when he came in as Chancellor, did two things. He handed power over setting interest rates to the Bank of England, and said, I'm not going to touch that. And he said that for the first 2 years, he wasn't going to basically do anything to change the policies of the previous Conservative administration. So all of the spending plans were fixed, and he didn't touch them. Now, this, of course, produced vast sums of money for the Treasury and enormous economic success, for which he took full credit. But I remember Rory Bremner standing up and doing his Gordon Brown impersonation at that time and saying that the policy of this Chancellor was to use the words prudent and sustainable as often as is prudently sustainable. And that was it. That was the policy.
I remember that sketch. amazing. I remember that. Yes. It was very funny.
And it absolutely nailed it, because all he did was talk about being prudent and sustainable. And that was it. He didn't do anything for two whole years. So that was the initial policy, was all about not frightening anybody. And then after they'd got over that initial 2 years, they started to do things. And then it started to go steadily worse and worse. So the removal of interest rate setting policy from the government to the Bank of England was certainly one thing. So that was a shift in the power base within this country, probably more towards the City of London and City of London interests, and away from the perhaps wider interests of the nation. And that was reflected in an ever greater concentration of power and wealth in London and the South East, which probably wasn't to the best interest in the nation as a whole. But that's what they did. And the other one was the assault on the Constitution, House of Lords in particular. You know, so these are the things that I took away as a sort of initial stabs at things. And they made one or two mistakes. I mean, the glorious mistake they made was the Freedom of Information Act, which I understand they regret, and has been a huge boon to all of us digging for information about what the government's actually up to. It makes it much harder for them to hide things. So they did do one or two positive things as well, but mostly by accident.
Yeah, that is quite amusing. New Labour is a fascinating phenomenon because, well, for multiple reasons, but one of them is it's the left becoming institutionalised in a way that hadn't happened before. It was merging in and replacing the establishment as we had known it. Now, you can say it had already taken place really from the 60s onwards, but I think that this was the formalisation of that in 1997. And then, of course, it proceeded to uproot anything that was in its way, and the House of Lords would be a key example of that. I think, is there anything else that we should say about Queen Elizabeth II before we move on to this sort of thing? Because I want to keep this relatively chronological.
In my essay, I raised a couple of points where she did speak out, And I was quite surprised how good it was. And I was quite surprised how far-seeing it was. And what was very striking is it got a very negative response. The nation wasn't ready. So my overall view of this is, yes, she didn't lead as I would have liked. Whether it was even possible, I'm not sure, because the wider problem is all of us. The wider problem is the nation and how we view ourselves and the way in which we've forgotten ourselves, forgotten who we should be and who we used to be. And that's not something that the monarch is going to be able to fix. That's something that we have to fix, each and every one of us.
But surely also another problem was the position that the monarchy had cornered itself into by then, which was largely an ornamental, a symbolic position, where you didn't have any influence, you didn't have any power. Yes, formally, officially, you do, but you never use it. Well, then she didn't ever use it. I think, and this is what I've been saying recently, this is my own position on this, is that people complain that the Queen never did anything. And it's understandable, because she's ostensibly a figurehead, she's ostensibly important, she's ostensibly influential. So you would expect her to do things to change the course of history, to rescue the nation and so on. But it's symbolic. It's a symbolic position by now. Therefore, she couldn't do anything. And what that means is that this is not how monarchy should be. Monarchy should not be symbolic or merely ceremonial. The monarch should actually have power, because otherwise, well, we'd be hoping for it. It's
beautiful. Well, yes, a couple of things I'd add to that. With Alex Thompson and Mike Robinson at UKCom, we did a series of talks some time ago on the Constitution. And one of the things that came out of that, the discussions, one of the things that came out of that was originally government ministers were not to sit in the House of Commons. Well, the House of Commons was there to hold government ministers to account. The government ministers were actually appointed by the monarch. And, you know, that seems like a wonderful system by comparison, because we can actually appoint people who knew something about the subject area and appoint them on the basis of, you know, the content of their character, and then let the squabbling rodents in Westminster keep them honest. That actually seems a much more workable system to me. So having that degree of power, I think, would actually be quite good. And you're talking about some genuine checks and balances, which obviously we don't have now, because with all the politicians being much of the same, it's an elective dictatorship, and there's very little that the ordinary man can actually do to have a grievance addressed, for example. And the other thing was just on the grievances, because as I was looking through correspondence that I was holding on certain cases that I've worked on, for example, correspondence from Robert Greene to the Queen, highlighting the Holly Gregg case, with a tragic case of a Down syndrome girl up in Aberdeen who fell victim to a powerful and well-organised paedophile ring. And Robert publicised this and named the individuals, and for his bother was arrested and put in jail twice. He was writing to the Queen about these events and asking for assistance in certain areas. And I found other cases where people had written to the Queen as well. And it struck me that the monarch must receive a constant stream of appeals for help for people who are the victims of the state. Now, power or not, the position is such that what is said is listened to, and nothing's ever been said. And I think if one or two of these cases had been championed by the Queen or by the current King, some of the things to do with child stealing by the state, the abuse of social services, and the attack on families, and you know, there are many cases, a lot of them horrendous, and a lot of them well documented and capable of being checked. And even for the monarch to turn around and say, "Well, I think these are good questions. I want these answered," would have had a big impact. That wasn't done either. And I think that could have been done, whatever the political settlement happens to be at the moment.
I don't know how anyone could object to that. How could that possibly get her into any sort of trouble to show concern about people, children being abused by by anyone? How could that possibly have been objectionable? So I couldn't agree more that it's ridiculous that she didn't say something about that. And I think a lot of people have this feeling of being aggrieved that they weren't helped, or that their issue that they care about was never addressed. The Queen never said anything about anything when she must have been aware of so much. I don't know. I just don't see how it's defensible.
It was a unique position to actually have the pulse, the temperature of the nation, to understand what the people were suffering, because the people were writing to her and will be writing to the King, and should continue to do so, in my opinion. Because eventually, there will come a point where someone will listen.
Yeah, well, I hope so. Well, that brings us to the matter of King Charles III, who was crowned this year. He seems like quite a different kettle of fish, in that his mother said nothing, whereas he doesn't seem to stop talking about politics and geopolitical arrangements. But it's from a completely different angle. It's globalism. He is apparently completely ensconced, completely enmeshed with globalist interests. I mean, as if being associated with Jimmy Savile wasn't quite bad enough, he's now with the WEF, with Klaus Schwab and so on. What would you say about Charles III?
It's a very strange thing to behold, because if you look at there was a lot of concern over the coronation, that it was going to be some woke pantomime, that it was going to take a coach and horses again through the Constitution, that it was going to innovate in horrible ways. And really none of that happened. What you got, with one or two small moments aside, was actually tradition that looked back millennia. This was very interesting, and it was a good start. And then the first few speeches were a good start. But we were all waiting. How would he deal with the causes that he had made himself famous or infamous for? The World Economic Forum and the whole nonsense over global warming alarmism, and the strange Gaia worship that comes from that, and the false religion that comes from that. And this is the man who just promised to be defender of their faith, and had even gone to define in the ceremony what their faith meant. And he didn't even hesitate to go down the World Economic Forum global warming line, and this seems to have captured him. I can't imagine that I hope for very much from Charles as a king, unfortunately. I would like him to prove me wrong. But there has to be a point at which the error has to stop. If you believe so many things that are just wrong, that are just false, if lie upon lie, falsehood upon falsehood constitutes your worldview, then when you open your mouth, what comes out, it's never good. And there has to be, for him to turn that around, there has to be a realization that he's gone seriously wrong. I don't know what it'll take. I don't know how many feet of snow we'll have to cover Balmoral before he maybe thinks that maybe global warming isn't the big threat. Maybe CO2 is not a pollutant. Maybe the scientific evidence that is out there that shows that it's actually beneficial should be listened to. But, I mean, what's it going to take to turn him around from his current course? I really can't imagine.
Yeah, it seems to be, I mean, it's not just about carbon, and it's not even just about climate change. He seems to have a whole set of values, a whole belief system that is quite new. You know, to compare it with his mother was different from the monarchs who preceded her in that she seemed to stand for quite little. She wasn't actively, obviously she was a Christian, but she didn't defend the church. She didn't stand for it. She didn't stand for traditional marriage or whatever, these things, the nationhood. She was just silent, just neutral on everything. And then her son is active, not neutral, but active for non-traditional things and non-national things. So it's a clear continuum there. And I guess the worry is, what will he authorize? What will he encourage, popularize in his reign? And then what on earth awaits us after his reign with Prince William? I mean, obviously, it looks like Prince Harry is off the scene. That he's not going to be the monarch, but Prince William probably is. And what would you say about his? What do you think is going to happen there?
So it's very difficult to know, because what do these people believe? You know, human beings are ultimately rational if you understand what the belief system is, how they actually see the world. Then generally speaking, they will react in ways which are logical if you understand the value system that they bring to it. Might look very illogical on the surface, but if you understand the value system, but we're not that complicated. But what's the value system? It's becoming less and less clear, because with the Queen, I thought I knew. I was maybe wrong. I mean, I might have been kidding myself, but I thought I knew. Because you got someone who was brought up, I mean, it wasn't all that long ago from Queen Victoria, right? Queen Victoria was monarch at the height of something like British Israelism. So you're talking about the view of Britain and the view of the empire as being a very clear force for good, having a very important and definite role in the world, and being very tied up with how you view God and absolute principles. And it was all on this level. It was on the level of the absolute, not the relative. It was on the level of good v evil, not political negotiation and compromise and pragmatism. And there's been a move away from that and towards the more pragmatic, towards the lesser, towards things not being things not mattering as much. It's just as long as we can get through the next week.
Yeah, much more the expedient and away from the perennial.
Yeah. So you've then got Charles. Now Charles is, I suspect, trying to push against that. He's just pushing in the wrong direction. He's seeing major problems and he's trying to take a stand on major problems. The issue is he's got all the answers wrong. I think he's got.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily even say that the motivation is necessarily. Well, there's a problem with the motivation being internationalist, because he's the king of, you know, Great Britain and the United Kingdom, and King of Scots, King of England. He's all of this, and there is a relationship with the people that's part of that. And you can't throw that away and pick up internationalism like a cheap suit and put it on. So the internationalism's a problem. I think that's a fundamental problem. The other things are more issues of he's misunderstood the science, he's not got the basic principles, and he's not asking the questions. He's being a dupe. This is not good. This maybe means he's badly advised, but surely, you know, he's got Google the same as everyone else. Surely he can go and see what the issues are, what the questions are, why people are thinking this is a disastrous policy, and start asking questions. He has a duty to do that. I don't see any sign of that. But there is at least a willingness to try and do something. Now, his son is keeping very low profile and is not troubling any sort of opinion with his interaction with it. So what does he believe? Two generations away from Elizabeth? I really wonder. I think where Elizabeth was motivated very largely by Christianity, and Charles obviously has some residual respect for it, but I don't have any. I can't detect that it's a major part of his life. Does the question even arise for William? I don't know. I fear not.
Yeah. I take the point. It's good that Charles is involving himself with things, with politics. He's much more active. And I think that is preferable. I think it is what people want from a monarch. It's said that the monarch shouldn't be like that, that that's not what the people want. But I think that's said by the likes of, well, champagne socialists, deconstructionists, and so on. I think the
people don't want a monarchy.
Exactly. So I think it's right that he's gone in a different direction from his mother in that regard. But I agree with you that all of his answers for the problems are mistaken, misguided, because of a worldview that he's enmeshed in. And therefore, I don't see how he can change. And after all, people don't change that much after a certain age, after 30, 25
yeah.
even.
Yeah.
So he's now, I think, in his 70s, I believe. I'll just confirm that. I think he is, he's 75. So clearly he's not going to, I mean, it's very unlikely that he's going to have some kind of epiphany at 75 and realize that all of this is a mistake and he's got to get back to patriotism and so on.
The smart money would not be making big bets on that. I will grant you that, yes.
Which is unfortunate, and you know, I wish it weren't that way.
I'm
not against him for the sake of it. I don't enjoy that. I wish we could reasonably hope that he would see sense, but I don't think it's going to happen. I do think it's more plausible that William would do it because he's younger. He perhaps sees more. I mean, obviously they are detached from normal life to a great extent, but he must see more of the decline than his father does and has throughout his life. So,
and he'll have to respond to events, and it's events that are going to drive this, and it's events that are not going to be in anyone's plan, because I think events are going to start to take their own direction, and the politicians and the monarchs and everybody else are going to have somewhat of a rude awakening, I suspect, as events take their own course. And the mistakes of the last 50 or so years start to be made all the more manifest. I mean, I feel that this 23 was a year of very substantial change in that regard, where problems that have been, well, they might have been discussed on Millennial Wars, they might have been discussed on Millennial over the last 9 years, but they weren't being discussed many other places. They weren't being discussed in the mainstream by and large, and they now are. You know, things that were ignored can no longer be ignored. And that's going to change whatever William turns out to be, I think, more than anything he might initiate himself.
That's an interesting review of the year. I think you're right. And we talked about this before we went on air. You say that it will... a change in William's or William's time, his reign, will be shaped by events, and it will be driven. Change will be driven by actual events. I'm sorry to be pedantic. I don't mean to be, and I understand that there is a need, both for rhetorical and practical reasons, for some degree of vagueness. But could you put your finger on what types of events we're talking about? What types of events or in what areas of life will these events happen that will trigger change in the future?
That's very tricky, right? But I suspect that we might be reaching the point where the strange interregnum between the end of the Cold War and now, where what has actually been the guiding principle of the world system during that period, it's drift and lack of direction and exploitation of the work of previous generations and the exploitation of the work of future generations via debt, and that it just cannot be sustained. I was looking at the figures from the United States. Their debt repayment is currently $1 trillion a year. Their total government revenue is less than $5 trillion. So you've got 26-27% of everything they bring in is already going on debt repayments. And that's before they refinance their debt stock. Once it's refinanced, it's almost double that. And so you've got, you know, 40%, something like that, of government revenue going on debt service. Now, that means that the debt's going to balloon at a huge rate. It quickly gets unsustainable. You get to 8-9% interest rates, and everything the government brings in is going on interest payments, and it's gone. It's all over. So that system can't go on. It must crack. It must change. Something must break. They either have to default or they have to hyperinflate the currency. They can't ever pay back the debt. They're adding debt at a rate that's never been seen before. And who's going to buy it? Right? The Japanese aren't buying, the Chinese aren't buying. The Fed's now not buying. They're meant to be quantitative tightening. They're trying to shift $8, $9 trillion worth of US debt this year to who? Who are the buyers? I don't know who the buyers are. So there comes a point where whatever they set interest rates at becomes irrelevant, because the market will define what the real interest rate is eventually, and then the whole thing's over. So if you end up getting a financial collapse, for example, what does that do to the entirety of the West? it'd be very substantial change. Now, historically, this hasn't always gone well. This is a chance for tyrants. This is a chance for empires to be built, tyrants to come forward. And Britain's role historically has always been resisting that, often alone. Will that be it again? Will we succeed if we have to do that again? I don't know, but I don't see this strange kind of unreal time that we've had since the Berlin Wall came down till now continuing for very much longer. I don't think it can be afforded. And then you've got the cultural aspects, and that's already turned because we've seen, I think we've seen the high water mark of the woke already. That's passed. We're seeing people pushing back with increasing confidence and increasing courage against what's been done to their families and what's been done to their communities, and are thinking more and more about how they want to live their lives and how they want what actually matters. The victory of the far left by default is over. They're now having to fight and they don't like it. And they're losing. We'll come to Scotland in a wee bit, I hope, because that's an example of how they're losing. So there's a change there too. I don't know exactly how that works out because there's both good and bad ways it can go. But what I'm suggesting is that the assumption that things will always go on as we've known them is false, that there's going to be big changes ahead. And as those big changes hit, positions like the monarch and the view of the British people will be changed, and they'll be changed by events, and they'll be changed partly by the force of events and not necessarily by their own thought processes. You know, it's the old joke about human beings can reason. They reason the way that cats can swim. They can do it. They just avoid it if it's at all possible. I think when it's no longer possible to avoid, we'll start to see people reasoning much more clearly.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right that it is an unsustainable situation. That's why I've been talking about it for so long, because I could see the danger, and it just didn't seem to be heading in a good direction. The world seemed to be heading in a perverse direction in multiple ways. That's going to end up in a situation that is either unsustainable, or you pray that it's unsustainable because it's diabolical. And I think people are now seeing that in a much bigger way. Obviously, I wasn't alone back then, and there were people who saw it many years before I did. I certainly wouldn't claim to be a prophet in that regard. But yeah, it seems to be, I think, especially over the last year or two, there seem to be multiple waking up points. You mentioned Scotland, and that's interesting. I've had two, let me see, I don't want to forget any, but I've definitely, No Chance and Unity News Network have been on and talked about Scotland. So I guess you're the third. So I think it would be interesting to talk about that because it does epitomize some of the problems, most of the problems that we're talking about here. Obviously, the SNP, well, why don't you take us back to the SNP before Hamza?
Yeah, I mean, there's several reasons for talking about this. And for those who are all over Scotland again, but please bear with us. There's a couple of good reasons. One, it's very, very funny. And in these times, having a good laugh at the incompetence of those who are trying to do us harm is good for the soul. It slockens my soul, as they would say in certain parts of Scotland. And the other thing is, Scotland's a strange little country. And it's been suggested to me that one of the issues is it's an early adopter. And it tends to be quite wholehearted. So when it came to Christianity, right, I mean, Scotland was Christian the way that England never was, because we really meant it. And when it came to technology and the embracing of education and the embracing of technological development, we were right there and we really meant it. And when it came to the empire, we were right there and we really meant it. Okay, so maybe woke is another example where we've been an early adopter, this time of a profoundly bad idea. But this has been pushed, and it's been pushed very hard, and it's always been worse in Scotland than in England. And a lot of the ideas have come from America or from international organisations. American tax-exempt foundations, American academics have pushed a lot of this. The ideas have not come from within Scotland, but they've been enthusiastically adopted by the Scottish political caste to the huge detriment of everyone else. And 2023 was the year when it all finally came home to roost, and it collapsed with, I mean, just hilarity. So I've got a few dates here. I'll keep this short, but I've got a few dates. So 22nd of December 2022, right? So just almost exactly a year ago, the Gender Recognition Reform Bill was passed by the Scottish Parliament. Now, this basically allowed, if you want to be a woman, Wos, you could turn around and fill in a form and you'd be a woman. No worries. No, essentially, no questions asked. So, January 2023, Adam Bryson was convicted on 2 counts of rape. And Adam decided that he was now Isla and put on a wig and was sent to Cotton Vale Women's Prison in Stirling, because this rapist was now a woman. And word got out about this, partly because of all the pushback by various groups in Scotland against the Gender Recognition Reform Bill. So, also in January, the United Kingdom government blocks the bill. So this is now a point of conflict between Holyrood and Westminster. So the issue starts to be, is Isla Bryson a man or a woman? And people, journalists who haven't held Nicola Sturgeon to account in years, start asking her questions about this. And she can't answer. So you got this big, I mean, he's a big thumping bloke and he's a rapist, right? And she can't say, so she says she doesn't have enough information. And for about 2 weeks, there were three genders in Scotland. There was men, women, and rapists. Because when people would ask her, is Isla Bryson a man, or Isla Bryson a man or a woman? Nicola would say, well, this thing I know, that person is a rapist. Sorry. So we had three genders, men, women, and rapists, right? And then we had, it just kept running, and it got funnier and funnier. So we had Alex Cole-Hamilton, leader of the Liberal Democrats, who are very left-wing, everything's left-wing in the Scottish Parliament, but they're out there, certainly socially very, very liberal. So he was asked on television, is Isla Bryson a man or a woman? I checked before I came on. He said he was not sufficiently qualified to make that distinction. Right? And Jim Spence, the commentator and journalist who was on the same panel, said, well, I've seen photographs of him and in Lycra running shorts, and the Tadger's a clue. Do you not think, this is, for those who don't know, this is a British word for penis, right? Do you not think the Tadger, I'm not sure I can say that on television, he said, but he did, do you not think the Tadger is maybe a clue? Right? And so Alex Cole Hamilton stuck to his guns that he wasn't qualified to say whether a rapist with a Tadger was in fact a man. So the whole political class, it got to a point where the entire country was laughing their heads off at them. Apart, of course, from women in Cottonvale Prison who were a bit concerned that they might be sharing a jail cell with a rapist. So this went on. Nicola Sturgeon fell apart visibly. And on the 15th of February, she announced she was resigning. She was off. And it was pulled together in hours. Right? This wasn't planned. This wasn't a retreat. This was running. She was cutting and running.
And do you think that was because of the trans issue? Because she denied that at the time in the resignation speech that I saw. I think it was the resignation speech. But it did seem it was very at the same time. So
Personally, yes, I think she had become a figure of ridicule, and people are just laughing. I mean, she couldn't go out in public. People were asking her questions about this all the time. She buckled. She buckled under the pressure. It's the first pressure she ever had. She buckled.
What it seemed to me was it was so ridiculous, because if this had been not Nicola Sturgeon, but a Californian professor of gender studies or post-colonial studies or something, they would have been really immersed in the ideology and they would have known how to answer the question. It would be a little word salad, but they would know what to say. Instead, it's Scotland, and it's a Scottish politician being called upon to explain and speak from this ideology, which she's supposed to have imbibed. She is supposed to believe in all of this, so she should be able to articulate it. Now, I think she would still claim to believe in it, all of it, but she can't articulate it. And what's interesting to me about that is it shows that, well, people are saying things, are even believing in things to some extent, or at least going along with things that they definitely don't understand, including political leaders.
This is a very important point, actually. This is vital, and because Nicola has always operated from the political mainstream, right, from the self-satisfied centre-left, and because they've always painted anyone with a different view as far right, literally Hitler, you know, all the slur words, all the smears. They've never had to defend the position. And this is where it's a big advantage to have an unpopular position. Because if you have an unpopular position, A, you need to be able to defend it in large ways and small every day. And B, you have to understand what the mainstream position is in order to argue against it. So you know both. And you know why you believe what you believe. Now, Nicola was always an intellectual lightweight. I mean, that's an insult to intellectual lightweights. She was always very limited in her intellectual capacity.
She's a good speaker, but she's clearly dull.
Yeah. And she'd learned, but she'd weaponized dullness. This is dullness actually as a political advantage, because if you're intelligent and thoughtful and questioning, you realise that the topics are difficult and complex, and there are more ways of looking at things than just one, and you'll tend to be quite modest in your pronouncements. If you're dim, none of this applies. You can have the confidence that comes from not grasping the issues, really. So she kind of weaponised this, and she'd learned a lot of things by rote. I mean, I met her once, I pushed back at her a bit on a particular subject, and it was like hitting the playback button. You got the line, right? And she learned her lines. This is what she did as a politician. That she was good at, but it wasn't based on understanding. So she resigned, okay? So they announced a competition for the replacement. And this was hurried. And this was, they tried to keep it kind of secret from the press, and that didn't fly either. Now, the two main candidates were clean living, fresh faced, Free Church of Scotland attending lass from the Western Isles.
That's Kate Forbes.
Kate Forbes, finance minister, and Humza Yousaf. Humza is of Pakistani ethnic origin, went to Hutchison's Grammar School in Glasgow, so relatively affluent upbringing in the city, in Scotland's largest city, but from an immigrant community, and so that was the choice, and his line, although he purports to be a devout follower of Islam, he's also a devout follower of woke, with all the support for LGBT rights and all the rest of it that goes with that. So these are intellectually incompatible positions. So he, like Nicola, is not a thinker, and he's very much Nicola's progeny. He's very much her. He was a continuity candidate. He was following on. He'd been inspired by Nicola. She was his mentor.
Yeah, it's worth contrasting the likes of them with the people who were in the Scottish Parliament at the very beginning, just for the first couple of years. I think, obviously, of Donald Dewar, for example. I think they were a completely different class of person, in multiple senses of that word. Would you not agree with that? They were far more intelligent, far more cerebral, thoughtful, far more worldly, and a bit more integrity, to say the least.
There's been a decline, and it's been quite striking. And what we've got now wouldn't look out of place in a small council or a middle management in a supermarket. It's that sort of level. It's very, very poor intellectually, by and large. A few people who are not in that category. But what's in the Parliament, by and large, and certainly what's in the SNP, by and large, very poor. And so Humza is looks up to and is inspired by Nicola, and she was inspired by Alex Salmond, who she tried to have convicted, which is another story, who she betrayed. And Alex Salmond, he was inspired by Mao Zedong. So there's a line here, and it's not necessarily going in a good direction. Mao Zedong and then downhill. So this was the election that was done. It was a runoff between Kate Forbes and Humza Yousaf. Now, everybody in Scotland who detested the SNP and everything done to the country, right? Everyone was thinking, oh, pick Humza. Oh, please pick Humza. And they did. Right? This was the biggest self-inflicted wound that any political party I can think of has ever done. Even worse than Jeremy Corbyn. Humza just does not work as the leader of the Scottish National Party for a whole lot of reasons, only one of which is his Pakistani origins. There's a whole range of reasons why it just doesn't work. Mostly because he's Humza, right? So he's got problems with arrogance, and he can be quite aggressive. And there's a whole lot of personality traits that you're thinking, I don't think this is someone that the Scottish public are going to warm to. So the first thing he did when he got into office is he held an Islamic prayer meeting in Bute House. Right? This was politically inept. The optics in this were dreadful. It went without much comment. Had Kate Forbes won, and the first thing she got is her family and the moderator of the Free Church of Scotland in for a prayer meeting in Bute House, the place would have erupted.
Yes.
But it didn't with Humza. So in he came. Now,
there's the photo that was...
Oh, yes.
Not only did he do this, but he had it photographed and tweeted it out.
Yes.
To the people of Scotland, so that the people of Scotland would know. And let's be honest, that is obviously a domination move. There, I don't see how it's anything but that. He was telling the people of Scotland, this is who's in charge now. If not yes. Islam itself, definitely Muslims. I mean, that's an ethnic insult there, calculated ethnic insult.
Well, what else can it be? This was the single worst thing he could have done on day one of his premiership. So in he comes, and then out of the blue, only another 6 weeks after this, the next scandal hits, and this is Nicola Sturgeon's Home Affairs. Now, the background to this is some years previously, the SNP had run a fundraising campaign to raise funds for the next independence referendum, which they assured everyone was just around the corner. They always do this. And they had quite a lot of success, and they raised £666,000. It's just a number column. And so this was meant to be ring-fenced for the independence fight. One of the people who had donated money was surprised when he pulled the details of the next annual returns to company's house from the SNP to find there was only £125,000 in the bank, and started to ask questions about where the money had gone. And he was told that everything was all right, not to bother his pretty head about this, and he wouldn't let it go, so he reported it to the police, and they rumbled on for month after month. But eventually, they decided to do something, so they raided Nicola Sturgeon's house. There was an incident tent in the front garden. They were digging up the back garden. Don't know what they were looking for. And it was all over the news. And this was a police investigation, which still goes on. Operation Branch Form, or Operation Brain Freeze, it's also known in Scotland, because nothing very much is happening, but it's still going on. So after that, Nicola Sturgeon's husband, Peter Murrell, who was chief executive of the party, he resigned. And then the ongoing investigation, I mean, it gets to a point where, on one level, it's funny. On another level, as someone who's Scottish, it's a little bit embarrassing, the sort of the nature of the corruption. They found that that one of the things that the SNP had bought had been a luxury camper van, which cost them £100,000, and for which they paid cash. Who does that, Colin? Pays £100,000 cash for a camper van, and it was located in the driveway of Peter Murrell's mother's house. So that was seized by the police. Murray Foote, who was the head of the press office for the party, he resigned because he was busily telling everyone that the claim that 30,000 people had left the party was complete nonsense. Apparently Peter Murrell had told him this as chief executive, and transpired it wasn't true. Or at least it wasn't the 30,000 people had left the party, it was 31,500 had left the party. So he'd been caught making false statements, so he resigned. And on it went. And just to circle round to the end of this little story, Humza then decided that he would take the UK government to court and have a judicial review, £250,000 taxpayers' money. It's okay, Colin, it's only mine, yours, and everyone else's. We're going to have a judicial review of the UK government's decision to stop the gender recognition reform bill going forward. So that was duly done, and the Scottish government, as is now traditional, lost in court, one of many losses they've had in court, and Lady Hale found against them and found that the UK government had acted properly. And the 20th of December, so 1 year on, it's only been a year, the Scottish government have said that they're not going to appeal that decision. So the Gender Recognition Act is dead. Nicola Sturgeon's political career is dead. Humza's political career is not looking healthy. And the SNP and everything they stand for is in ongoing disarray. And that's where we're at. And the takeaway for people who are not Scottish from all of this is that the woke ideology, the belief system that it generates, which is one of its cultural Marxism. It's attacking everything constantly, always. It's destroying and destroying and destroying and assuming that the new utopia will emerge. This doesn't work, that we knew, but people are catching on and people are asking serious questions and they're not finding any answers. And the peak woke has been passed.
This is an interesting event here. Do you think that the SNP was... See, there's a theory that the SNP was put in... That hierarchy at the SNP were installed by Westminster or by the powers that be in order to discredit Scottish nationalists, Scottish independence. But I don't really believe that because they did very well in 2014. I mean, the independence referendum nearly won, I believe. I can't remember now, but I think it was 55 to 45.
That's correct. So,
yeah. I always get it mixed up with Brexit, which was similar. I think that was 51 to 49, something like that. So it nearly won. So I don't think, I mean, if they were installed to discredit the cause, I don't think I don't think they did very well. So that makes me think Scotland nearly did go independent in 2014. Therefore, they were sincere about wanting independence. Nicola Sturgeon, Alex Salmond, although he was kind of out of the picture by then. And now you've got this chapter in the story. And some people think that the establishment, the powers that be, have made this happen. For example, the investigation into Sturgeon and the way that was carried out was kind of humiliating. Perhaps it could have been done in a more low-key way. Perhaps she didn't need to oust herself. But I think you're saying that she did that because of the trans issue. Basically, I'm surprised by all of this because my notion was Scotland is going to go independent. It's just a matter of when. And it might be 100 years from now, 50 years from now, or even 5 years from now, but it's going to happen. And that, I think, was a safe assumption to make up until this whole debacle began with Nicola Sturgeon. What would you say to that?
It's a very tricky one because Alex Salmond got into government in 2000, and memory serves correctly, 7. And he got in much to his surprise. And he got in as a minority administration. Now, the rest of the parliament and the country as a whole took the view, look, okay, they haven't got a majority, but this whole parliament was set up to basically prevent the SNP winning, and they've won. They have won the right to have a go at governing. So, as a minority administration, let them govern. Now, the minority status did keep a little bit of a lid on things, kept a certain amount of reasonableness. But Salmond is a much more astute politician. I mean, from Mao to Salmond is a drop, but from Salmon to Sturgeon's a drop, from Sturgeon to Humza's a drop. It's a decline each stage. Salmond was a much more astute politician. And whilst I don't believe his act, he's very good at it. He'll feel well-met, affable, you know, likeable. This is the persona he puts on. And he's very effective. So he took the view that, look, we're going to govern in such a way that we're going to build up support for independence. We're going to show that we can do it better. So there was an inherent competition against what Britain was doing. if he could show that Scotland, with a bit of governance, a bit of self-governance, could do consistently better, he could put it to the Scottish people and say, look, we're ready. It's time to go. And because of things largely out of his control, oil price, for example, the revenues were quite good, right? So Scotland was a net contributor at this point to the UK, not a net beneficiary. And things were going reasonably well. And when things weren't going reasonably well, I mean, he made horrible mistakes, but the horrible mistakes take a little while to play themselves out. He came up with a scheme called Name Person, which was terribly authoritarian and fascist. It was horrendous. But that took a while to be resisted, and ultimately they lost at the Supreme Court again, and ultimately it was quashed. But that takes a while to work its way through. So that was only ongoing. So they hadn't really had the big defeats by this point. And they picked 2014 for the referendum. Right, this is 700 years on from 1314, Battle of Bannockburn. It was the year after the 2 years after the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, where Scotland competes as a separate nation. So there's a lot of flag waving, and Scotland did very well in the games, and there was a whole lot of things. Plus, the Unionist side were just woeful. They were dreadful. They couldn't come up with a single positive reason, and they tried just putting fear into people, and it didn't work. And the support for Scottish independence, which had been languishing mid-20s to 30% for decades, shot up to 45%. And they almost got there, you're quite right. But, and it's a big but, the belief systems underpinning this are Maoist, they're far left, they're Marxist, they're socialist, they represent failure. And there's no basis for building a country. Therefore, the longer they go on, the more they're found out. So because there was only 7 years from first getting into power to the referendum, they hadn't got found out. Now they're found out, and the long decline is in. Now, there's still a problem, because A, they've been proselytizing the youth in the schools. So the support in young people for Scottish independence is very high. And that's a politicisation of education, for sure. And a wokeification of education. So we're not caring about the nation or the family or anything like that anymore. We're woke now. So that's a problem. And there's still no opposition. I mean, the opposition is still... It's absent, right? Most of them are busily surrendering to the same sort of ideas that the SNP are pushing. And then you've got the Conservatives, who surrender all the principles and then try and argue on well, we're better managers. You know, no one's pushing back against this. No one's pushing back with ideas that says this is fundamentally wrong. We need to be going in a completely different direction. But nonetheless, the ideas themselves have been shown to be failing. And the longer it goes on and the more you've got failure, it's not the basis for setting up an independent country. And the more they build up the state and the more the state's a drain on the real economy. I was told the other day 17% of people in Scotland are net contributors to the taxation revenue, and everyone else is on the take. So eventually you just exhaust your 17%. And they either go or decide not to try as hard. And every time they put up tax, the revenue's falling because Laffer curve. It's a disaster because it's built on policies and ideas and ideologies that are guaranteed to fail. So the longer it goes on in that direction, the less and less likely independence is, because more and more people will see this is in fact a failure, and to be on our own with such a failure would be a big shock. So that's the problem they've got. The advantages they've got is they've managed to indoctrinate the youth, and Westminster is in a shambles, and the political right is non-existent. And the Labour Party, which is the other main opposition, is full of contradictions itself.
Yeah, and led by a Pakistani as well, which is completely surreal.
They both made the same racist speech. They both made the same speech about white people.
Yeah,
it's just the Labour chap made it first, and Humza copied him.
the arrogance is off the scale and absolutely amazing. But I guess a problem here, as you say, is that Westminster isn't offering something. I mean, obviously financial, economic benefits. Yes, it's probably safer for Scotland to be part of the United Kingdom for that reason. But there's nothing more than that. There's nothing existential or transcendent about what are we, who are we. Indeed, the answer to that is being muddied all the time with mass immigration. Nobody knows what it is to be Scottish now. Years ago, you could give a pretty clear answer to that, but not now.
Yeah. I sat down with two people from what you might term the right-wing margins of Scottish politics a few days ago. But these are people who are, they're not mainstream exactly, but they're trying to win in the mainstream, right? So their views are by no means extreme. In fact, their views are, if you go back to, say, the mid-1950s, would be viewed as entirely middle of the road, right? So you're talking socially conservative, but, you know, in no way extreme in their views. And I asked them both, well, what do you think is the major issue that's going to be facing you in the next year? And they both said, not a moment's hesitation, mass immigration. I thought, well, that's interesting, because I'm absolutely sure that if I'd asked these people a year or two ago, it wouldn't have been that. And it was not only the lack of hesitation, there was no embarrassment about saying it, there was no mass immigration, that's the biggest issue that faces the country. So I came away from that, I thought, well, if these guys, who are very moderate, socially conservative, and probably represent the real beliefs of most of the nation, even if they don't represent the real beliefs of most of the political class, are saying that. I bet that's what a huge number of people in this country are thinking. So that's one aspect of it that's going to force people to change. And the other aspect is people are not buying the cultural Marxist stuff in anything like the extent that used to, or they're not intimidated. It's not, I don't think they ever really bought it, but they were intimidated by it. The fear's going, right? You know, the line from government always has two levels, right? Level one is a pitch, right? That you must support immigration because, you know, it's necessary for taxation revenue or to support the NHS, whatever, right? There's some pitch. And if you analyse that and look at the facts, it melts away. And if you do that, what used to happen was you'd just be called a racist. And you'd be called a Nazi and you'd be called all sorts of bad words. And people would be intimidated. People are not intimidated as much anymore. They're not buying it. So that's not true. Can we talk about the facts, please? And that's a change. I see that as a it's not the whole, it's not all the way there, and it's not universal by any stretch of the imagination, and it certainly doesn't apply in the institutions. The institutions are still horribly, horribly woke. But people are pushing back, and the institutions are going wobbly, and the people are finding courage. And I find that encouraging.
Definitely. I think that the words like racist and so white supremacist are definitely losing their power. I think that it's nowhere near what it was 5 years ago or even a year ago, actually. And I don't know exactly why that's happened, but there are some events. I think Elon's Twitter is one of them, but I think it must be broader than that. For one reason or another, it might just be overuse of those terms, saturation. And also that, as you say, the woke ideology in as a totality has always been foreign. It's always been strange to people. And now it's having effects, that real world effects, that are just ridiculous. So that's, I think, not taken seriously by people. And therefore, the concept of racism is also falling away. I also think that people are just seeing, as their societies crumble, they're feeling that a renewed sense of peoplehood, which was kind of negated by economic luxury, by plenty. So for that reason, it makes sense to them to care about their own people, to care about their own kind and their own country. And then when someone calls them a racist for doing that, it just doesn't wash anymore. And of course, there are all these other examples from around the world that you can point to where people do care about their own people, their own country, and it's absolutely fine. No one cares. So I think these contradictions that only white people are held to this standard, only we are expected to be okay with being demographically dissolved, that is increasingly obvious to people. But I think mostly it's that their countries are changing rapidly with demographics. And nobody likes it. There's no reason to like it. The incredible range of restaurants, big deal. There was a Chinese takeaway in the time before all of these immigrants. So it doesn't matter. No one believes that we need them here in huge numbers in order to have this kind of thing. So it's obviously absurd. So I think for all these reasons, those insults, those put downs, racism, white supremacy, are falling away. And I think that can only be good, because it means that we can return to a sane and sensible discussion of what we want for our societies and for our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, there's a return to reason, and some of the hard intellectual yards has been done by thinkers in this area, people like James Lindsay, who have been analysing, goodness sake, poor soul, reading what the left have been putting out over the past 50, 60 years, and saying this is where the ideas come from. If you want to know what your drag queen story time's about, this is the original paper that explained what they were trying to achieve. It's horrendous. You know, if you go to the original paper on queer theory, the number of references in that, in slightly coded language, but still very clearly referring to paedophilia, is extremely concerning. And this was the core paper. This was what set the whole thing off. And when that starts being pointed out to the people in our institutions who are pushing this, they don't know. They've not read the papers. They've not thought about any of this. And of course, they crumble. They don't want to have this discussion. And people are finding, hey, wait a minute, we can win. One of the things, when you're up against the state, you're up against all the institutions, one of the things is people get a mindset where they always think that the other side have got them, right? They've got all the money, they've got all the organization, they've got all the power, they're going to win. And that's deeply imbibed in people that we're on the losing side. And I've seen multiple cases where I'm watching reporting or part of campaigns, and I'm looking at these people discussing what they're going to do when they lose. And I'm thinking, guys, have you seen what's happening here? You're winning. No, 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 no. We know we're going to lose. No, it's what we do after. No, no, no. Stop and think about what to do when you win. And people who are up against all of this institutionalized power find that very difficult, because they find it difficult to imagine they can win. But time after time, I've seen them win. Because if you get the intellectual work done and you win the argument, you win the intellectual struggle, the rest of it is usually just a matter of time and persistence.
Well, I'd hope so. I do think that when we saw, and everyone saw, Nicola Sturgeon unable to answer simple questions about the trans case, the prisoner, the rapist case, it just gave the lie to the whole thing. It's obviously gobbledygook, and she obviously doesn't understand it, but she's tasked with pretending to understand and approve of it.
Both Humza Yousaf and the Labour leader in Scotland, when they made their infamous Whitey speeches, I wrote to them both. I wrote to them, each of them, three times and said, I want to do an interview with you. I want you to explain to me what you understand white to mean. Okay? That's what I want to talk about. Now, I got zero replies. They totally ghosted me. It wasn't just go away, I don't want to do that. I never got a reply from either of them. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't even acknowledge the request. That's how much they were running from that issue, because they were terrified. Because I don't think for a moment they knew what they'd actually bought into. I know what it means because I've read the literature. They don't.
Don't you think that they know that it's not them, and that's all that matters?
Well, maybe people we hate. The definition of white is people the left hate. Maybe in their world it's not any more complicated than that. But they should be at least ask the question: why do we hate them?
Oh yes, oh certainly. I couldn't agree more. Well, this has been a very interesting talk, David, so thank you for doing it. There are a couple of super chats, so I'll ask those to you now. MI5 Surveillance Van says, when I was a boy, I remember my dad telling me that Prince Charles liked to talk to pot plants. Back then, we chuckled, little did we know.
Well, actually, the reason that works, if you talk to pot plants, they grow quicker. And the reason that works, and it works better if you're a woman because you're shorter, is you exhale CO2, and CO2 is plant food. So you really should know.
I see. I'm surprised the effect is that pronounced. And then he also says, I saw a sticker in the toilets at a pub, make cash great again. It made my day. Yeah, this is a thing. You start to see, as you said, the issues that we've been talking about for years. And you know, the cashless society thing really came up about 3 years ago during COVID. But other people were talking about it before then. Issues that we've talked about for years are now in the mainstream, in the sense that ordinary people that you would assume to be normies, not that political, are aware of them. And so you see things like that written in a pub toilet. It's quite strange and encouraging.
I tell you a quick little story. I went along to, during the Scottish independence referendum 2014, I went along to Dundee to see Kenny McCaskill give a talk. And at this point, the SNP were busy introducing armed police into Scotland. And they'd stopped some poor little pensioner near Inverness and held him by the roadside for 4 hours under armed guard for doing absolutely nothing. And there was a lot of people really pushing back hard against the sight of armed police in the Scottish streets. So Kenny turned up to Dundee to talk about how wonderful the new independent Scotland was going to be. And a whole pile of people turned up to discuss with him armed police and really gave him a bit of a doing verbally. Kenny wasn't having a good day. So after about half an hour of this, they said, well, we want to move on to another subject. Have you any other questions? And so one of these guys put his hand up and asked him what his view was on returning to the gold standard. And It was a wonderful moment because you're this quite, you know, lame politician. Clearly, he hadn't a clue. He didn't know anything about the gold standard. He'd never even the issue of real money and money with integrity, as opposed to fiat printing or debt-based currency. None of these subjects that the audience was actually quite well versed in had ever passed through his tiny mind. And again, he really struggled, and it was quite funny to watch how out of his depth he was against an ordinary audience of ordinary Dundonians. It was very interesting to see.
It's worth saying that he is 65. He's not some pup, and you know, of 25 or something. He should know better. That's quite surprising. And then not finished says Hamza, Varadkar, Sunak. Why do we tolerate this? I can feel our ancestors grabbing us by our collars, shaking us violently, and screaming at us, saying, "What are you doing? Why are you letting this happen?" You know, I agree. You have my sympathy.
I wonder how long that's going to continue. Right? Is this some point where the British will turn around and say, "No, actually, we really want someone British." You know, we're not talking about being anti anybody, but the disproportionate representation is just, we don't want that anymore. I wonder how long that will be. I think that might come.
Well, I certainly hope so. Not finished also says, can we really win an intellectual struggle when the majority of our countries are filled with NPCs? That's an interesting question. The agency of the general public.
Well, I've seen it done, right? The thing about NPCs is the N, right? They're non-player characters. They're not in the game. You're only having to defeat the people who are in the game. There was a piece by Kemi Badenoch, the government minister, who talked about the difficulties she'd had inside her own department getting access to a person who had detransitioned and was talking very effectively and movingly about the hell they'd been through with gender reassignment surgery and puberty blockers and hormones and all the rest of it, and the scarring, and then having to try and reverse some of the damage. All right, so this person's life has been very largely ruined. And they were saying, well, look, I was an unhappy teenager. I mean, you know, goodness, there's plenty of those about. I was an unhappy teenager. What I actually needed was someone to talk to. And they put me in this medical pathway. And before I knew, I had breasts cut off. And I was told I'd be happy as a boy. And it was all a lie. So Kemi was trying to see this person. And she was being blocked by her own civil servants. And she summarized it as follows. She says, 20% of the civil service are activists. And they're actively hostile to basically anything that's good. Most of the rest will just go along with anything. They're the NPCs. So the person that's made that comment is right. That is the majority of the NPCs. They'll go along with anything for an easy life. And she said, and there's a few of them that are really good. So you've got a remnant that are really good, and that's the people we've got to share information with and build up and support and listen to. But the NPCs will go along with anything for an easy life. That's the solution to them. You make damn sure that if they're doing the wrong thing, they don't have an easy life. They'll fold. You've actually only got to defeat the activists. Yeah. And that's a battle of ideas.
Yeah. Okay. Well, excellent. This has been a really interesting talk, so thank you. We'll leave it there because I've got the next guest on in 5 minutes. So I'll have to close this one now. But yeah, okay. I will be back then. I think it's Frodi on next. And in the meantime, David Scott, thank you. Well, you're starting Northern Exposure.
Starting Northern Exposure. First broadcast is going to be called Notes from the Edge, and it's all about ideas. It's going to cover a lot of Christianity, a lot of geopolitics, a lot of science, a lot of everything. So hopefully people will join me for that, and I'll be looking for lots of audience feedback. So please let me know what you think.
Okay, excellent. Good luck with that. And in the meantime, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
It's been a real pleasure, Colin. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Find the info at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.